Blog Talk Radio.
We have here at the Fitch Radio. I know that this is a Wednesday evening here, 7 o'clock on the West Coast, 10 o'clock on the East Coast, but it's a very special edition of Suspense Radio that I wanted to bring out because our guest is going to be author Hugh Howey, who's we saw a couple posts from him on a lot of stuff that's going on with the publishing, and I wanted to make sure that I brought him on so we could talk about everything that's happening because there's so many different things that are going on in the publishing world and the business side, aside from just the author side and everything else, that we just want to try to make things more known so people have more information on everything that's going on and try to diss some of the things that are happening that might not be happening, but what you're hearing. So, without any further ado, we are going to start Suspense Radio 60 Minutes, and it's going to come up right now. So here we go, everybody, and we are going to welcome our guest onto the show today. He's going to be on hold all hour. It's going to be the two of us. His name is Hugh Howey. Go to hughhowey.com, H-O-W-E-Y. See a lot more information that he's got going on. And, Hugh, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Hey, man, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, John.
Absolutely. We talked a couple weeks ago, saw a couple of the posts, wanted to make sure we get you on. But the one thing that we're going to get into first here is you know, you're an author, you have award-winning series, you have the Silo series, you have the Molly Fide books. So let's kind of get into your work here a little bit, and then we'll kind of do the business side at the end. So right now you got three books in your Silo series with Wool, Shift, and Dust. Give everybody a little bit about, you know, your writing style, the things that you got going on, because you're one of the only authors I've ever seen on the site that actually has a progress meter. You're telling people exactly how far along you are with each book that's coming up, and I find that totally amazing and refreshing to see that you are that interactive with fans and with readers that are out there.
Yeah, well, it serves two purposes. One is to keep myself accountable, and it's like the gamification of exercise and various other things that require self-motivation. By making your progress known, it keeps you motivated to work on your, move things forward every single day. And it also lets people know when the next project will probably be coming out and what book it is. Since I'm on my own release schedule, things come out when they're ready, not according to any seasonal schedule. And I don't really do lengthy pre-order windows. So as soon as it's done, it's back from the editor and the final touches are complete, I hit publish and it's live. And this way people can see, like, if the work is at 20%, it's, not coming out anytime soon. When it gets into the 90s, they can start bugging me with emails about when the next book will be released.
Yeah, don't you love when readers like to bug you about emails and sit there and say, so when's it coming, when's it coming, when's it coming? Like, Jesus, let me at least write it.
No, the best is that you know, I love it. It's when you don't have anyone clamoring for the next book, that's frustrating. And the best problem to have is our readers dying for sequels to several books at once. But when you hit publish and then go to sleep and you feel like you've got this huge load off, and you wake up in the morning and someone's read the book overnight, left a review, and they've emailed you asking when the next book is coming out, that's when you've got rabid fans, and you really feel like you can't take any time off. You got to keep working to keep the readers happy.
So give us a little look inside the Silo series. Now that you got three books out, Wool number one, then Shift number two, and Dust number three, for people that are just kind of finding out about you, what can you tell them about the Silo series as it's progressed kind of so far, kind of a little inside information into it?
Sure, and the series is wrapped up too. It's a trilogy, so everything is finalized with Dust. The first part of Wool came out in July of 2011. It was just a short story originally, and it was like my seventh or eighth published work, and it was the one that really took off, and I guess you could say it went viral. I mean, the sales just almost went exponential within a couple of months of that story coming out, and so readers demanded more, and I started writing more. And it's this post-apocalyptic tale of people living underground. They live in this massive silo that goes down 150 levels, and it's self-sustaining. People have lived there for generations, and no one knows how they got there or what the outside world is like. And the story revolves around this mechanic named Juliet who gets promoted to sheriff and starts to uncover the secret behind the world that they live in.
And when you started thinking about, like, the series Silo, was that something that you wanted to explore yourself as an author? Like, you're wondering, you know, of course, you know, there's a lot of post-apocalyptic writing that has happened before, and everybody has their own kind of take. So was that something that you were very curious in, that was, like, a subject matter that you wanted to explore further when you decided to write it?
I was more interested in creating a microcosm of the world we live in. You know, there's a lot of allegory in what I write. So I think of the Earth as being a lot smaller than we tend to think of it. You know, it's like really the only habitat we have for supporting ourselves. And I know this is a common angst for a lot of science fiction fans, that we feel like we should get some of our eggs into another basket somewhere, and that's difficult to do when we're spending all of our time and resources squabbling over the land that we have here. And you know, if we took all the resources that we're spending defending against one another and fighting one another and poured that into research and exploration, I think we could accomplish some pretty crazy things. Unfortunately, that's not what we do, and Wool is a look at, it's a very dystopian book, and a look at kind of what things that are, I think, can be improved with our world and our systems of government. So it was written at the height of the Arab Spring, and while Occupy Wall Street was going on, and I was really commenting on a lot of world events while I was writing it.
And it says also on your website that the series and the book were optioned by Ridley Scott and Steve Zaillian for a potential feature film. Has anything moved on that front yet?
Yeah, I mean, it's moved farther along than I ever thought it would. I stay very pessimistic about the film. I think it's safer to assume that nothing will come of it. Matter of fact, the last email I just read before I called you was from my literary agent who was filling me in from an hour-long conversation that she'd had with our film agent. And yeah, we've got a studio on board and excited about it, 20th Century Fox, and they've recently renewed the option and they've written a screenplay, and a lot of things have happened that I did not expect. So I remain pessimistic, but people attached to the project think that has some sort of a chance of actually getting made. I just don't want to let myself believe that.
Yeah, that's one thing when you're dealing with Hollywood, you have to remain, I like to say, cautiously optimistic that things will happen. I mean, you know, living in L.A., I hear a lot of stories from Hollywood, a lot of things happen. And quite frankly, you just have no clue, and that's the one thing. Until, I guess, it says it's ready, released, and here you go, then you know it's actually happened.
Yeah, I think when I watch my ticket getting torn in half, that's when I'll believe that this is a real thing. But I've got a friend who's whose book was it was a done deal. It was going into production, and the lead the star of the movie pulled out 2 weeks before principal photography, and it put the entire thing in limbo. So you can get that close to the thing moving forward, and have something get in the way. So you know, with the books, I can control every bit of it, and that's what I like to focus on. And I'm just flattered to have someone like Steve Zaillian and Ridley Scott read my book and enjoy it. That, to me, that was I could have died happy just then.
Yeah, I mean that's cool. Just, like you said, just in itself to be able to have that happen. And now Random House is picking up the hardcover, putting it into the UK edition. Was that something that you were kind of a little pessimistic about? Because since you've been, you know, doing things on your own, going this route to maybe have someone else have a little bit of control?
No, I was really excited about the Random House deal. We had already sold foreign rights in a dozen or so other countries by the time it went to auction in the UK. And you know, I was doing well enough in the U.S. market. I wasn't really penetrating the U.K. market, the print-on-demand. The print-on-demand resources had not yet opened up there. The e-books didn't sell nearly as much in the UK as they did in the US. So I was making, you know, a really comfortable living here in the US. And I saw the UK deal as this perfect opportunity to work with a major publisher, work with an editor in my language, because all the other deals were in foreign languages. So I was not involved in the editing process at all, and not impact what I was doing here in the U.S. So it was just the absolute ideal situation. And my editor at Random House in the U.K., Jack Fogg, was a dream to work with. He's become, consider him just a really good friend. And they did an unbelievable job marketing the book. It was a Sunday Times bestseller. It, you know, it has a great contract and it already earned out and continues to make money. And it's been one of their big successes of the last year. So it's all been wonderful.
Yeah, I'm sure that you probably didn't imagine when you decided this is what you were going to do that maybe things would take off so fast. But when you started seeing everything that was happening so quickly, how were you able to kind of still stay back and still be kind of the same person that you are? And really kind of, you know, just kind of keep who you are.
You know, I don't know that I am. I was kind of an insufferable prick before all this happened to me. And somehow all this nonsense is like really leveled me out. I feel like I'm more grounded now than I was before. I'm so awed by the entire situation that it makes me feel very, very small, and also feel very not in control of any of this. I think because all of this happened organically through word of mouth and through the readers, I feel like I'm being swept along on something that I don't have much control over. And my job is to enjoy and appreciate every moment and appreciate every milestone and every day. And you know, I've told my wife for 2.5 years that this is the absolute height of this. And you know, I was seeing this when the first part of Wool was only out, and I sold like 1,000 copies in October of 2011, and I told myself it'll never get better than this, and I've told myself that every single day, not because I'm anticipating impact, but just to absorb every day as the best that I'll ever have. So I think the best thing that's come out of all this is something I don't talk about much because it's not something that comes up in interviews much, but the weird personal growth opportunities that have come out of this, where dealing with getting lots of praise and also lots of criticism, and dealing with having your life become more public. It's really been, some things have been very stressful, and working through that, I think, has helped me grow as a person, where, you know, I don't take criticism the same way I did 2 years ago, and I'm better at accepting praise, which is something I've never been good at. Yeah, so I, you know, beyond the dream of being able to write for a living and make enough money to retire on and things like that, I think being challenged by having this thrust on me has been one of the coolest things to come out of this, and to just trying to manage expectations and my own goals and personality. That's been one of the things that I would not have expected out of all of this.
And so, aside from your writing, you've also now, with all the business side stuff that's been coming out, with Hache to Amazon and those battles and all the other things, you still found time, and you wrote a couple very interesting pieces that are listed on your website. Again, that's HughHowie.com. And the first one you did, which was in June 14th, and you said big publishing is the problem. And this is kind of the thing that kind of went a little viral when, you know, it was Hache going against Amazon. Of course, now people might think it's Hatchet, but I will just say that the reason why it's not called Hatchet is because they're owned by a French company, and a lot of people might not realize that they're owned by a French public company that's traded on the French stock market called Hache. So it's not an American company. But that's one of the big misnomers,
which people don't know. And that company is owned by, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but it's one of the largest arms manufacturers, I think, in France. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're in books. Amazing, isn't it?
Most publishers are owned by something else, something larger that can, because right. You know, publishing is kind of a low margin. I think something just came out recently that they make, they might have a 10% margin, which is a lot better than bookstores and some other book-related industries, but they're mostly owned by larger corporations that can help infuse the cash needed for advances and help absorb any potential losses and things like that.
Yeah, like Simon & Schuster is owned by CBS. And so there's always something underneath somebody else. And again, I don't know how many people actually realize these things, saying that, of course, people are taking sides. I mean, there's authors from Hache coming out speaking bad about Amazon. I don't think Amazon's really been that big in coming out and trying to, like, defend themselves, because, quite frankly, I don't feel they've done anything wrong. If anything, I think that publishers should be rejoicing to the fact that Amazon's doing what they are doing by taking things worldwide faster than they have. The one thing that I think that publishing, big publishers, hated the most was that they no longer had the control that they used to have. They were no longer able to limit the supply that was out there so they can take the bigger and the bigger profits that they were in the meantime. Amazon allowed people to do self-publishing like yourself and like millions of other authors. So I don't think they cared for that. But when they saw the way that music and movies were going, they had to know that when they became digital, that this was going to happen, and that something was going to happen that they weren't ready for.
I don't think they did know that this would happen. I think there were a lot of people in publishing.
They were just closing their eyes and they were keeping themselves in the back room. Either way, they screwed it all up.
I think there's a lot of people in the publishing industry who see books as being fundamentally different than films and music and photography and other things that have been radically impacted by the internet and the digital revolution. There's a sense that books are a cultural, they have cultural significance, the physical object. And I think a lot of us do this. I have the same this problem. I'm sitting here looking at a room full of boxes of books that my wife and I are going through, because we own literally thousands of books that we have in storage, and we're sorting through them now. It's easy to conflate our love of story and our love of knowledge story being fiction and knowledge being nonfiction. Of course, the two often blur between those two lines, but we conflate our love of those two things with the love of the physical object that holds them. And readers are discovering more and more every day that their love of story and their love of knowledge transcend the medium that it comes in, that if it comes on a tablet or a phone or an e-reader or a laptop, they have the same attraction to that. Now, there'll always be people who will prefer the physical book.
Sure.
But, and the problem with Amazon is not just e-books. Half of print sales have now moved online. And publishers are making decisions today that I think are not good for themselves because they're trying to preserve the culture of bookstores. And I think they need to not worry about that. I think bookstores are going to survive in some incarnation with or without their help. I think there will be enough people in the large cities to support bookstores. In smaller cities, you're going to have libraries that are going to become the resource for the physical book. But more and more people are going to get their books online. We're still going to have reading culture, and that's what we need to concentrate on. It's not protecting a middleman, but concentrating on what's best for the reader and what's best for the writers. And when you see most coverage in the book industry, there's another report out today, a big slam on Jeff Bezos in the Sunday book review in the New York Times. And this entire story is just like all about the book industry. And there's absolutely no talk of writers in this entire story. And there's no mention of readers. There's only a mention of customers in this one sentence about how Amazon does a good job of servicing their customers. But the rest of the story is about like the impact that Amazon and Jeff's movements with Amazon, the impact that it's having on bookstores and on publishers. And I just don't understand this. I don't understand why, as much as I love bookstores and have worked in them and would love to own one, I don't understand our focus in all of this revolution being on the middlemen. I think our focus should be on the writers and the readers. Just like in the music industry, our focus should be on what the musicians are doing and what people are listening to. And
right.
For some reason, in the book industry, we don't see that. We see people just consumed with how things are going to affect these multi-million dollar corporations and not the people on either end of those corporations.
Yeah, I didn't see any big publishers getting together and stepping up and trying to save Barnes & Noble. I saw Microsoft trying to do it, which now looks like it could be a problem. But I didn't see them trying to step up and do anything. I don't see them trying to keep independent bookstores open. I just hear them. And, of course, the one thing, I mean, hardcovers were making such huge profits for them. But now they're trying to control the e-book price and to try to keep their margins up. But you just can't because there's a lot of people selling stuff for $2.99, $1.99, 99 cents. There's free. I mean, it's all over the place that they had no choice but to make these things go down. But they're still making very good profits. I mean, let's face it. No one's shut the doors yet.
Yeah, no, the e-books have a better margin for them than the hardback.
They do.
This is one of my biggest complaints as a writer. They're making more profit on an e-book than they are on a hardback, and the author gets a much smaller cut of that share. And the reader is paying more for a digital book than they paid for the paperback. So, again, readers and writers are getting hammered, and publishers are making out like bandits. And that, that's getting zero coverage. It's baffling to me when Hollywood went through this, where digital downloads and streaming started becoming a revenue stream for studios, the writers who are being left out of these revenue streams because their contracts did not provide fair royalties, they got together and they had a functioning union, and they were able to fight. And we do not have that as writers. The Authors Guild in the U.S. is a complete joke. If you look at all of their releases and all of their points of view, it's all in support of the bookstores and the publishers. And
right.
those people have their own, lobbying strengths. They do not need the Authors Guild fighting for bookstores and publishers, that these the Authors Guild basically is run by the big name authors. Scott Turow just finished his term there. Thank goodness he was an absolute mess. But they want to preserve what's been great for them, which has been
exactly
the
that's
bookstores
what
that give them.
Yeah.
And, well, it's what's made them multimillionaires. And there's no one fighting for the beginning authors, the mid-listers. There's no one speaking out for them. And Amazon has done more for the mid-list author who relies on their backlist by keeping it in print and available forever, and done more for the beginning author by giving self-published authors an equal platform, that a functioning Authors Guild would be singing Amazon's praises for everything that they do for writers and for expanding readership by keeping costs down for books.
Exactly.
But when the people running that organization have been made wealthy by just a handful of publishers, and when they have nostalgia for bookstores and care more about that than they care about readers and writers, then you have a very warped perspective, and that's that guides their principles. Unfortunately, writers just do not have any power as a collective at all. There's absolutely no group. There's no organization looking after them. People who are locked in with a publisher are scared to speak out if they have bad experiences. No one's allowed to talk about their contract terms. It's just really a really horrible situation. It has been for people have been complaining about publishers for thousands of years, but I would say in the last couple hundred years, we've just had a mess of the power differential between publishers and authors.
You know, I'm going to get into this because you touched on something that's very important, because I don't know if you realize that we have a publishing company and we did something that was very interesting. I don't think anyone ever did. But we're going to get into that in just a second, because we're going to take a short break. We're going to get back because, quite frankly, I'm thirsty. I need something to drink, and I'm going to have me a piece of Lindor chocolate, and you don't want to hear me on the air anyway. So we're going to be right back here in a second, right after this. So hold on one second, all right? Here we go. Welcome back, everybody, here after the break. Again, we are joined with our guest, Hugh Howie, best-selling author of his series, The Wool Series, along with a lot of other stuff that he has going on. Right now, we're discussing the business side kind of publishing and trying to get involved a little bit in what all the stuff is that's going on out there. And Hugh, like, you brought up a good point because you were saying that a lot of writers are worried about their publishers. Their publishers kind of put a little fear of God and stuff into them. Well, the one thing that we did is we opened up Suspense Publishing and we're publishing books. We went around Thriller Fest about 3 years ago. We decided, you know what we're going to do? We're going to ask a bunch of authors what they like and don't like about their contracts because we wanted to do something that was different. We wanted to be innovative like a Google and Apple and Amazon, the three companies that I always say if you want to know what's going on in the world, you look at those three and they'll pretty much tell you the pulse of the world and everything that's happening. So we decided that we were going to give the authors the rights to their work, that we were publishing it. We have a highest royalty rate of anybody out there. I mean, we're 80% in some cases, a lot of things. And we just decided that it was the time that the authors needed to enjoy themselves in writing, not worry about it, and have control of their work because they're the ones who did the work. And that's the one thing that we wanted to try to be refreshing was we didn't want the authors to have a bad experience. We wanted them to be happy. They write better stories. They like what they're doing. And they're not sitting there worried and sick about, you know, selling and everything, and am I doing everything? But we just thought that it was a much happier experience for them, which makes us happy and makes them happy, because we started the magazine to help people come to one place in the genre where you can find out information about mystery, suspense, thriller, horror. That's what we wanted to do, because there was just no place people could go. So that's what we've been trying to build here for the last 5 years.
And you guys promote people sharing information about their contracts. You don't care if authors
discuss
all the terms.
They can say anything they want. I mean, it's not a secret. I mean, that's the thing. Nothing's a secret. I mean, if people want to say how much they make at their job, at their salary, I go ahead. Say it. I mean, people have all these secrets, and then when there's all these, this is just my philosophy, and I could be wrong. Half the time I am, but half the time I'm right. But I just think that when there's all these secrets and all these things going on, then people start reading in way too much to things instead of just being honest and just saying what stuff is. I mean, it's a lot easier. That's the one thing when I always say, whenever people read a story, don't technically read the words on the page. Pick out the things that are omitted from the story, because if they're not talking about it, that's where the real problem lies. If they dart around a question, if they don't get into a topic that hard, or things like that, that's where the real answer lies, is in the omissions of stories.
Well, I think that's the reason you're able to – no, I totally agree. And I think the reason you're able to share information about your contracts is because you're proud of them. I think, and I've seen authors just in the last year share information about their contract and immediately have to take that story down because their publisher tells them to. I can think of a couple of examples specifically where we watched this happen on their blogs. This is something I just mentioned at a conference I was at this last weekend. I wish publishers would, you know, look, if you can't pay authors anything better than, you know, $1.20 per paperback that you sell, you know, the bookstore and the publisher are both making more per sale than the author. Mm-hmm. At least own that, because as a reader, I would love to know. I think on the back of the paperback, right beside the price, you should have how much the author is making from that paperback. And instead of being embarrassed about it, share that information with the reader. And also put the PayPal account of the author right there. And this, I'm saying this as a reader and a bookseller. So when I enjoy, you know, the last book I just finished was a book by John Green. Now, John Green's doing fine. He's making a lot of money, and he's making a lot of money off of his film. But still, if I enjoy a meal or if I enjoy the service at a restaurant, I love giving a great tip to my server.
You're tipping.
After reading
you're tipping.
Yeah. And after reading this book, if I close this book and see, oh, my gosh, so John just changed my life. You know, I paid $15 for the book, and I think, you know, I supported the author, and then I see, so $1.20 of that went to the author. Here's his PayPal account. I'm going to immediately get on PayPal and send him $5. And I don't care that he's a millionaire. I don't care if this is a first-time author. You know, the experience is the experience. And, you know, publishers are never going to do that because they would have to advertise how poorly they pay their artists. But if they did that, mm-hmm. their artists wouldn't be paid as poorly. A lot of readers, even kids in high school, kids who don't have a lot of money, would send a dollar or two to their favorite artist. We know this from musicians who allow sliding scales and where you pay whatever you want to pay for their albums. When you give people that freedom, they tend to overpay. So instead of hiding how poorly authors are paid and how few authors out there are making a living, we should allow these authors to blog about their contracts, blog about their earnings. And like Amanda Palmer, who I think has broken so much ground for artists, and her TED Talk on this topic is you have to see this. She talks about how difficult it is to learn to ask her fans for support, but how honest that transaction is once she was able to do that. And publishers, I think, could, you know, they can't charge more for their books because they're competing with other forms of entertainment, but they could help their authors earn more money by saying, like, look, we're not paying them. Maybe you can pay them. And that would be, I think that would be a huge improvement for the standard of living for all writers, and it would come directly from readers. And, you know, we would see where contracts need to improve and where earnings for writers need to improve. I would love more of that transparency. I think a lot of change could happen by just a better understanding of what's going on in that market.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, the transparency is definitely something that is missing within here. But I mean, you know exactly. It's kind of funny because you know exactly what every athlete makes on their team. You pretty much mm-hmm. know what every actor is making in their movie. The music industry and the books are the one thing that you don't really know what the artists are actually bringing in. But artists from music do come out and they say, we make zero on our CD sales. I mean, it's pretty much done now. They only make money
yep.
touring. They're like, there's no money yep. in CD sales anymore. But
touring,
the only
touring
way,
and t-shirts.
Yeah, and the only way really that an author can make money is selling books. They're not going to make a bunch of money on the speaking circuit. They're not going to make any money doing, you know, endorsements and advertisements like, you know, like the other three things I just made. So the only way that they're doing it is taking their blood, sweat, and tears from their computer, putting it on the paper, getting it published, and then seeing what they get, you know, what comes in. That's their only form. They really have no other way to make money, which is why you probably only have. And I haven't seen the figures, and I think it's kind of difficult for anyone to say. I mean, I've seen a couple percentages, but maybe only 10% of our authors are actually making a living and just being authors.
I doubt it's
and not doing anything else.
I doubt it's that high. I doubt
well, see, that's
it.
The thing.
Really
I was thinking it's more like 6 or 7, but I gave the benefit of the doubt.
And, you know, that's including authors who are published. You have to think about how many people
oh, yeah.
are trying to make it as a writer and not getting through the very first of the gates. So it's a very difficult thing. But there are ways that we could, you know, it doesn't have to be the case that authors only make money through their book sales. I think, you know, if publishers really wanted their authors to earn a living, they could put together reader events where you send, instead of sending one author on book tour, just try to hit the bestseller list, organize book events with similar authors from the same genres in one location and have it just be all about the readers and connecting the readers with the writers. And maybe for these events, let the author have a much higher percentage of the sales for, and I don't think any publisher's ever done this, but if you go to an event and sign books, what if the author made 100% of the profit from the sale of those books? That is, the publisher would keep, you know, their production costs, but for those sales where they got the reader out to the event and they're signing the books and they're spending their time, you know, doing readings, like let them earn their money there. And instead of just sending out your big name authors, attach some new up and coming author to that author when you put them on a book tour. You know, we do this with, in the music industry, we have opening acts, and we use this to build up their name recognition. In the film industry, you're drawn to one film, but you see the trailer for five or six other films to try to drum up interest. Well, you know, if the publishing industry had a little more creativity and a little longer view, when they sent an author on tour, they would get one of their authors who's within a few hours of that location to show up and do the signing with that author, you know, and do a reading before that author or with that author to try to increase exposure for someone someone up and coming who needs the extra resources. So I think there's solutions to these issues. Just really no one seems to be experimenting or thinking outside the box. We're just doing the everything the way it was done 10, 15 years ago or 50 years ago. And we're hoping to have the same results. And, you know, every other entertainment industry is being completely upended by these trends. Mm-hmm. And publishers can pretend that Amazon is causing this, but they're not.
No.
If it wasn't Amazon, it would be someone else. You know, we have the same fallacy when it comes to all technology. We think that, like, if it wasn't for the Wright brothers, we wouldn't have airplanes today. And that's just, you know, it's ludicrous.
Okay, that's intelligent.
Well, we should sleep, and we have to celebrate. We have to celebrate the people who were there, you know, a month ahead of their competitors. But in the case of Amazon, we're blaming them for the decline in bookstores when the internet was going to do that no matter what. Publishers should have embraced Amazon for cutting down, the cost of their returns from 50% of bookstores in some cases down to 5 or 4% at Amazon. This is on their physical books. For inventing e-readers, which is getting people reading in rural places where they didn't have access to books, making their books available worldwide, creating a customer service system that is, you know, second to none and basically serves as the customer service for publishers. There's so many advantages that Amazon provides, and publishers are just consumed with the, you know, they don't like anyone having that much control over their industry. But if they don't want to innovate and create this marketplace on their own, they should figure out how to work with Amazon instead of, you know, colluding and working with their competitors to try to tear them down. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, the thing is what I don't see is, I mean, you want to talk about who the evil empire is. The evil empire in this whole freaking thing is Barnes & Noble. I hate Barnes & Noble. I won't shop at Barnes & Noble. I do not like them. And I'm going to tell you why. A lot of people don't realize, first of all, that when they walk into Barnes & Noble, the first thing they see is they see that nice display. They see the table and they see the rack. Okay, well, publishers had to pay Barnes & Noble to get their books in there. That wasn't Barnes & Noble being nice doing that. That was sitting there and they were putting their books on there. And they're getting paid a lot of money, whether it's regionally or nationally, to get those books on those shelves. But you know what?
Well,
the other thing is, no one's mentioned about how Simon & Schuster and Barnes & Noble are fighting. Simon & Schuster can barely get their books in Barnes & Noble. My publishing company can't get anything in Barnes & Noble. But you know who doesn't care? Amazon. They'll sell no matter who the hell you are. And they'll put you out there and they'll make you feel just like you're one of the crowd. But Barnes & Noble won't do that. They won't do
that. And publishing companies like yourself and the small and medium presses, you know, some of them still, you know, anyone who loves books and blames Amazon for the decline of bookstores has some hostility there. But small and medium publishers, they love, just like independent self-published authors like myself, we love that we have a platform that gives us, you know, equal status. I'm sure big publishers hate that. But, yeah, I was one of the Simon & Schuster authors who was caught up in the Barnes & Noble mess. I used to work at Barnes & Noble, and I went by the planogram and laid out books. Now, the thing that troubles me about the way those books are displayed isn't so much that the publishers pay for those spots. It's that a nice independent bookstore wants to put out books that the owners and the workers of the bookstore think the customers want. It's a much better experience. You end up finding better books.
Right.
This is, I think, what's why Barnes & Noble is hurting and why their Nook is being spun off, and it's lost them, you know, maybe over $1 billion today.
Oh, yeah, $1 billion.
One person's added up. So they manipulate their online bestseller list as well. Publishers can pay to have titles bumped up their bestseller list, and they artificially push down self-published authors. And we have
what you're talking about now, by the way, everybody, is something else that Hugh published on June 18th called Why the Analyst Got It Wrong. You can go to HughHowie.com and read that blog. So go ahead.
Yeah, so you know, I'm shocked that none of this is being reported on, but some romance authors who are self-published were having their books on BarnesandNoble.com artificially suppressed down to position 126 on the store, which would get them off the front page or off the front 100 and then some. And so you would have books that were selling, you know, those authors would share, like, look, I'm selling, you know, 6,000 copies a day. I'm the number one book in Amazon. This is how many copies I'm selling on Barnes & Noble. I should be ranked number one on their store. And instead, I'm stuck at 126, and I've been there for a week with no movement. That's because they're pushing up on a artificial barrier. As soon as you as a retailer start hiding the products that your customers want, you're cooked. I mean, there's no way that philosophy is going to result in anything but you going out of business, because you're saying, okay, we've got our hottest product. It's selling like gangbusters at our competitor stores. Let's hide it in the back room because we don't like the way it looks, and we want our store to look a little bit different, or we want to take money from a big publisher and put that book up front and take the book the customer wants and hide that. It's baffling to me. I don't know how stockholders would react if they knew that the company they're investing in is hiding a product that their readers are demanding to purchase. I mean, this is it's insane. It's getting absolutely no press, and this has been, you know. I agree with you. Barnes & Noble has been the worst thing for publishing. They've had way outsized power over publishers, and they're the ones who really drove out the independent bookstores.
Because they basically really had no major competition for brick and mortar. They were about it. I mean, they had independents in maybe certain cities, but they had no national competition, and they still don't. They had Borders, but Borders lost their way a long time ago,
Borders is out of business. Since Borders own Walden Books,
but that was the only competition they. But that was the only competition they did have nationally. You know, 5, 6, 7 years ago was Borders until they totally lost their way, and then when the e-books started coming out, one of them had to go. And it was Borders first. It just so happened it was Borders first instead of Barnes & Noble. Maybe because they got together with Starbucks. I don't know.
I don't think it was e-books that drove Borders out. I think it was Amazon's ability to deliver print books. And this is
true.
This is kind of an insane theory, I think. But we have to figure out how to explain these numbers. So,
insanity on the show. That's what we are.
Well, follow
this. I'm insane all the time. People hear me.
This is my Rochambeau theory of what's going on in publishing, and it's you've got three players, and each one is strong against another player and weak against another player. So you have independent bookstores. You have the big box discounters like Barnes & Noble and Borders and Books A Billion, and then you have the online distribution, which would be Amazon, Overstock, Walmart, places like that have good websites. So when it was just the independent bookstores, Barnes & Noble came in and they offered bigger selection, lower prices. And it felt like a bookstore. They had the physical presence, and it felt like a bookstore. So people flocked to those bookstores, and the mom and pop started going out of business. And, you know, there's even movies satirizing this, and you've got mail. But,
yeah, wasn't there a Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan movie about that or something? Yeah.
Yeah, you've got mail, and
you've
so,
got mail. That's the one it was.
Yeah. So the big discount bookstores were crushing the independent bookstores. Well, Amazon comes along and offers even more selection and even better prices. So for the people who value that, Amazon crushes the big box retailers. If all you care mm-hmm. about is price and selection, big box retailers cannot possibly compete. So in this Rochambeau triangle of rock, paper, scissors, Amazon crushes big box retailers. Big box
Amazon
retailers
have less overhead. They have less overhead, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the shipping almost negates the convenience of in, you know, going to a store and picking up. So follow this. Amazon crushes the big box retailers because of price and selection. The big box retailers crush the independent bookstores because they have a location in your community and they have more selection. They have, it's a bigger space, and they can afford to open up stores everywhere. I mean, they were very predatory with how where they opened up stores and how they priced their books. But to really complete this triangle, independent bookstores offer something that Amazon can't touch, which is personal curation and a sense of literature in your community. So the numbers bear this out. As Amazon has grown, the big box retailers have, you know, Borders has gone out of business. Barnes & Noble is closing 200 stores. Meanwhile, independent bookstores have seen a 10% year-on-year growth for 3 years in a row. So while we think that Amazon is the worst thing to ever happen to independent bookstores, the truth is it was Barnes & Noble that was really bad for them. And now Amazon is basically taking the predator out of the ecosystem, and independent bookstores, I think in the next 5 or 10 years, we're going to see them completely thrive, and we're going to have two separate ecosystems, the online shopping and the community bookstore, and I think they're going to coexist. Now, of course, we would love that, as independent booksellers, we would love that none of this ever happened and that, you know, independent bookstores were always the only thing around. But, you know, living in fantasy is not an option.
Right.
I think the real solution is to appreciate the fact that Barnes & Noble is hurting, and that there's now room in the marketplace for independent bookstores to cater to the readers who want a place to go and shop for books and to be around readers. That's my feeling.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's a crazy theory, but it could be that Amazon is going to save independent bookstores.
It very well could. I mean, and that's the one thing, again, like you said, that's not being publicized because, well, you know, let's see. Like I said, Simon & Schuster is owned by CBS. Yeah, what do you know, a news organization that's probably not going to help that out. Along with, you know, I mean, I send Jeff Bezos a Christmas card every year. He probably doesn't realize it, but I just thank him so much for opening up this store and doing what he does. And, Amazon did one thing also that a lot of stores could not do, and that was they could reach any place in the United States or in the world with a book and a CD. And they started out as a book CD thing, because I remember CD Now and Amazon were kind of together, and then they crushed CD Now and they were doing the books. But they were able to reach people that were not able to get stuff so easily anymore. And they made the ease so much better.
Speaking of reaching people, so this is I thought this was a cool way that Kobo. I just did an event in Canada, and Kobo, which is one of the great ebook retailers out there, they do DRM free EPUBs, and they're in so many countries, and they've got a really brilliant website, and they're great with self published authors. But I did a signing in Toronto, and what they were able to do was with me, we were able to offer a free ebook for everyone who got a signed book from the bookstore, which is helping drive physical book sales. And myself and Kobo, we're willing to take the loss to do that, to get people out to the event. So they not only got the ebook of the book they were buying, they got a second ebook of mine for free. And the cool thing they did, they were able to email everyone, all of the people who have bought my books within an hour's drive of Toronto. They're able to reach thousands of readers with an email blast, that's information that bookstores do not have access to. And
right.
Kobo, as a digital company, had access to that information, and they were willing to give away e-books as promotion for their platform and in support of the bookstore. And, you know, these are the ways that bookstores and digital distributors could work together and team up and concentrate on how we please the writer and how we make the readers happy instead of, you know, squabbling over the same piece of the pie, really.
Yeah. Well, Hugh, I'll tell you what, you were correct because the hour is gone, and it did fly by. but I'll tell you what, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Hey, anytime, you know, you got anybody who wants to talk or, you know, wants to promote or do whatever, you just send them my way, and we'll see what we can do, and because this is a great conversation, and I could talk about this stuff for hours just because I think it is so informative, and I think it's stuff that people need to hear and understand and hear perspective than maybe what they're reading out there and maybe be able to piece their own stuff together. So I want to thank you for coming on. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
All right. You have a good one, Hugh, and we'll talk with you later.
All right. You too. Thanks, John.
All right. So again, everybody, that is author Hugh Howey. Go to hughhowey.com. Like I said, you can read his news feeds. You can read his blog sites. You sign up for his newsletter. And don't forget, when you're there, check out his books. You can check out his Silo series, along with his Molly Five books, a lot of stuff he's got going on. Just a fabulous guy. It was great to have him on for the first time. So, everybody, we want to thank you all for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it wherever, however, and whenever you listen to the show. We will be back on the air on Sunday with Suspense Radio One-on-One. Listen to Crime and Science Radio on Saturday. This Saturday, they're going to have their guest on this Saturday. So until then, everybody, we want to thank you all and enjoy. So have a good one.